The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bjorkman, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Cleary, the Honorable Lois DeVray Bjorkman presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is February 25th, 2021. We have five cases on the calendar this morning, the first three scheduled for oral argument. The first matter before the court is State of Minnesota versus Matt Vogel. Counsel, I know you are familiar with our procedures, and while we may be Zooming, our procedures have not changed. You will each get 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Should you choose to use it, it's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may we'll wait till we get the timer. There we go. All right, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Eric Withall. I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Appellate Public Defender's Office. I appear before this court today representing the appellant in this matter, Matt Vogel. We're asking this court to permit Mr. Vogel to withdraw his guilty plea. We actually stayed this appeal and sought the court's leave to remand it to the district court for post-conviction proceedings, where we developed two issues at the evidentiary hearing, the first being Mr. Vogel's right to effective assistance of counsel, and the second being the intelligence of his plea under the manifest injustice standard. I'd like to start by discussing the intelligence of Mr. Vogel's plea in the context of the manifest injustice standard, that Mr. Vogel needed to understand that his guilty plea constituted an affirmative waiver of the right to appeal a fully litigated dispositive issue concerning his constitutional right to a speedy trial. So, Judge Cleary, is your do you have a question? I saw you're unmuted. So I'll move on. So the argument is premised in a few well-established principles. That first, there exists the right to appeal in a criminal conviction. The second, that an indispensable component of an intelligent plea is the defendant's understanding of the rights that he waives by pleading guilty, and that, you know, that it is a direct consequence of the plea that by pleading guilty, you waive your right to appeal non-jurisdictional defects.
Counsel, I do have a question. Counsel.
Sure.
Before we get to that, and before we get to Rule 15 and the level of intelligence of your client's plea, how relevant is the posture of this plea? In other words, your client was facing the forfeiture by wrongdoing that was outstanding before the court when he decided to plead guilty. So he pled guilty to one count, two counts were dismissed. Up to that point, it didn't look like he was interested in pleading guilty. So my question is, at what point does that become relevant? In other words, it appears, although he was pushing his issue of speedy trial, that now faced with possible witness tampering and what that might result in the forfeiture of the witness, that he pled guilty, got a pretty good deal, and now is talking about appellate issues. What relevance does that have?
The benefit of the bargain might be relevant to the district court's analysis of the prejudice prong and the Strickland analysis, but there's no prejudice prong analysis in a valid waiver, in the validity of a waiver of the Minnesota constitutional right to appeal a pretrial ruling.
I agree. But it does go to the intelligence of his plea. In other words, that he was seeking this deal, facing deeper problems, and was no longer concerned with the speedy trial demand. I mean, I understand the appellate right and the analysis, but getting on to that, what relevance does distinct possibility, the language that his lawyer used, what relevance does that have?
Well, it's equivocal. It doesn't affirmatively advise Mr. Vogel on whether he is actually waiving this right. In order to put a defendant on notice to be able to say, hey, this person, this unsophisticated criminal defendant, understands the consequence of pleading guilty as a waiver of a right, he needs to be affirmatively advised. So we can look to Minnesota or United States Supreme Court precedent like Boykin, which and also Rule 15, both in Minnesota. Both of these support the well-established requirement of the district court judge to ensure a defendant's understanding of the rights he's waiving by making a record.
Well, shouldn't that be in Rule 15.01 then? And it isn't.
I think that Rule 15 incorporates the form plea petition, which they don't do in Beltrami County. The form plea petition has line 23 that talks about waiving procedural defects, essentially, and they use this kind of artful language to say that appeals are apparently a waste of time. I would encourage the court to review line 23 of the form plea petition. I think it's a little bit concerning, but it does incorporate the idea that defendants should be advised of the right to an appeal and what it means. The United States Supreme Court in Roe v. Flores-Ortega, that's cited in my brief, discusses the role of counsel in advising a criminal defendant of their right to an appeal, recognizing an affirmative duty where a reasonable defendant would want to appeal, and number two, expresses an interest in appeal, that counsel has an affirmative duty to advise their client and consult their client on their right to an appeal. This is baked into the intelligence prong analysis, which kind of presumes competent counsel, which was not the case here. So going back to the initial question of how is this equivocal advice from defense counsel to Mr. Vogel relevant, it undermines all of these presumptions in an intelligent plea that the attorney is competently advising their client of the rights, not only the trial rights, but the other rights that they waive by pleading guilty, because it is the defendant's right to understand these things. It's particularly concerning, this well-established principle where defendants automatically waive their right to appeal these non-jurisdictional issues. Defense counsel doesn't know. Defense counsel testifies that he asked his colleague. His colleague doesn't know that pleading guilty waives this. And then there's a dearth of evidence in the record at the time of the guilty plea of Mr. Vogel's understanding of his waiver of this right. It's the court's responsibility to ensure his understanding, just as it is counsel's obligation or affirmative duty to consult their client on this right.
If I could interrupt just one more minute. So is it your argument that the court has an affirmative duty then to inquire about being properly advised about your appellate rights? Or not?
Yes. I mean, the court has the duty to affirmatively inquire about the defendant's right to a jury, the presumption of innocence, confrontation, cross-examination. They go down the list and they use the plea petition in most of these guilty pleas that I review and this court reviews. In this case, they did their own modified approach, but particularly concerning in this case when it comes to the right to an appeal. This is an issue that is affirmatively and fully litigated and is dispositive. In a case where a defendant comes in and pleads guilty and hasn't raised any challenges that may have been dispositive or even influential on what a trial and the issue of guilt might look like, there doesn't really, under the Flores-Ortega analysis about whether a reasonable defendant would appeal and whether a defendant has expressed interest in appealing, it doesn't make a lot of sense to talk about the right to an appeal. That's not the case here. They filed a lengthy brief on this. I think it was meritorious. I'd like to present the merits to this court on appeal. We can't because it's waived. But that is, I think, highly relevant to the question of what the court at the time of a plea needs to advise a defendant of concerning the right to appeal, especially when it is a fully litigated dispositive issue like this one.
Well, and is it appropriate for us then to weigh the likelihood of success on the speedy trial motion? I mean, it's sort of in part the question that Judge Cleary asked or similar to it. I mean, is that appropriate for us or for the district court or us to assess in evaluating the court's ruling on the post-conviction petition?
No, I mean, the drawing guidance from Flores-Ortega and Garza, these cases don't look at the underlying merits of the issues that would be raised, particularly because they're not briefed and presented to this court. I think this court would be hard pressed to evaluate this issue without the benefit of briefing from appellate counsel on this. In order to fully evaluate the strength of this speedy trial issue, this court would need to get argument and briefing from both sides on this. Looking at an issue that can't be presented to this court as being relevant on the issue before this court strikes me as inconsistent with this court's the scope of this court's ability to review issues that are preserved and not waived.
I have a question going off on a different tack now about this court's role, because my concern in reviewing the briefing and reviewing the post-conviction court's ruling is it seems like you're asking us to second guess the district court's credibility determinations. That's what it seems to me. Why am I wrong about that, counsel?
You can't second guess the district court's credibility determinations. What I'm asking you to do is to actually honor and respect the district court's credibility determination. That's their realm. That's their discretion. This court is bound by that. I want to be really clear about that. What I'm presenting on the prejudice prong analysis, assuming that this court doesn't find it presumptively prejudicial like in those other cases I cited, is to review the evidence and testimony that the post-conviction court considered and expressly found to be credible. And the post-conviction court could not have been more clear that everything that trial counsel testified to was entirely credible. The district court didn't pick apart his testimony and say that there are some inconsistencies and some problems here, or I believe him to the extent that it supports this conclusion. Is entirely credible is what the post-conviction court characterized trial counsel's testimony as. So this court can review the accepted and uncontested fact and apply them to the law on the prejudice prong analysis to reach the conclusion that Mr. Vogel was prejudiced by counsel's deficient performance that is not at issue here.
My question is, where is the line here? I mean, if his lawyer had said, I'm absolutely certain that if you plead guilty, you are waiving any appeal rights, arguably we wouldn't be here. Here we have the distinct possibility that you are waiving your appeal rights, and that's the record, and your client understands that and makes the decision to go ahead. I'm having a hard time figuring out, you know, where a line would be drawn between, you know, your client did weigh the issue of the appeal, right? It's not an issue that was not provided to him.
Yeah, you know, I think a way to evaluate this is in the context of less controversial affirmative rights. You might have a jury, you might be presumed innocent, you might get to cross-examine witnesses, maybe. That's not affirmative advice in an affirmative waiver. We're talking about the validity of the waiver based on the requirement to create a record that demonstrates the defendant's affirmative understanding of the rights that he is waiving, not It's possible. I'm not sure. I asked another attorney. She wasn't sure either. I never told him after pleading guilty. I said, if you don't like it, you can appeal. That's his testimony. That's trial counsel's testimony. I don't think on this record, even though there's some concerns about the fact that maybe he received some benefit of the bargain or was concerned about some forfeiture by wrongdoing, you know, I don't agree that that was a benefit because his criminal history score is non-negotiable. This is a presumptive state sentence. All of these factors don't weigh against Mr. Vogel, even if they were relevant, and they're not. Because the requirement for a valid waiver requires the defendant to affirmatively understand and for the record to show this, because the record does not, and because we affirmatively proved at the post-conviction hearing that he was misadvised on this, all of these things together invalidate his conviction. We ask this court to permit Mr. Vogel to withdraw his plea.
Thank you, counsel. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court and Mr. Withall. My name's Dave Frank, and I am the Chief Assistant Beltrami County Attorney, and I will be representing the respondent today. Your Honors, this case illustrates appellant's pre-plea strategy of avoiding a prison sentence. And in implementing that strategy, he employed multiple tactics. The first tactic was to demand a speedy trial. And I want to be the first to say that that tactic makes sense, it's proper, and it's constitutionally protected. And it was motivated in this case, as the record will show, because the record in the pretrial hearings indicate that the state was having a difficult time finding a necessary witness, the victim of the assault. And it was proper for him to enter that speedy trial demand use the tactic and the objective of scheduling a trial ASAP to try to catch the state flat-footed. Again, a viable and appropriate strategy. The record also reflects that the state made the parties aware of its difficulty in finding that necessary witness and requested a continuance beyond the 60 days in order to try to get that witness served with a subpoena. From the state standpoint, and this was never really, issue was never really fully litigated, but it's usually handled pre-trial. But the respondent believed that Mr. Vogel, the appellant, was at least partially involved in making that witness unavailable. Again, the record is unclear whether we would ever be able to complete that, but that was an argument made. And at least preliminarily, the court thought that argument had merit. The defendant changed tactics prior to the trial. And he changed the tactics to, instead of trying to stay out of prison, employing the speedy trial tactic, the tactics shifted to an argument based upon criminal history, based upon recent appellate decisions at the time, namely Scovel and Strobel, which allowed the defendant to argue that the court should reevaluate the criminal history points based upon the Strobel and Scovel decision. And now, after reviewing that very recent appellate history, we believe that the defendant would be under the line. The appellant would be under the line. And that's...
Can I interrupt just real quickly?
Judge Siegel.
So was there a benefit outside of getting out of jail in pretrial detention? Was there a benefit to Mr. Vogel with the plea? I mean, was there some negotiation over, you know, which would be the predicate offenses that would keep him, out of a presumptive commit?
There was, Judge Siegel, and it benefited both sides, quite honestly. I think it benefited Mr. Vogel by having the state agree to using particular predicate convictions for domestic violence related offenses, and it gave the state an opportunity to review that Scovel and Strobel decision. From the respondent standpoint, there was both a benefit to Mr. Vogel and there was a benefit to the state. We didn't have to litigate that issue of Crawford forfeiture. From the state's perspective, we may be in pretty good shape, but I suspect that trial counsel for Mr. Vogel would take a different view. So the tactics shifted to get a benefit of the bargain. That is what Mr. Vogel did, and that is what he benefited from. And I think the factual background, that dimension of the factual background is very important to consider.
Counsel, I'd like you to focus, if you would, on the Strickland second prong that that your opponent has been arguing, the prejudice prong. Would you address your viewpoint on that, please?
Absolutely. Under Lee Hill and the state Supreme Court of Campos versus State, the appellant must show that but for the error, he would have not pleaded guilty and insisted on going to trial. The appellant's post-conviction claim was that he would unquestionably have decided to go to trial absent a guarantee by trial counsel. And when the court reviews the evidentiary hearing transcript, the court will see that the petition claim was unsupported in the record. Appellant gave wildly inconsistent testimony regarding trial counsel's advice on appellate review. First, he claims that Mr. Schindler Syme trial counsel was unsure of whether or not going forward with the guilty plea would interfere with his appellate rights. That's his first claim, but then he completely shifts gears several minutes later and claims that his attorney guaranteed him that even with going forward with the guilty plea, that he would have that appellate review preserved. It was not credible, and the court has to measure that incredible statements by Mr. Vogel on the record against the fact that he knew he was getting a benefit of the bargain when he chose to switch tactics from, and knowingly and intelligently deciding to switch tactics from speedy trial demand to arguing his criminal history score. This inconsistent testimony.
My concern, Mr. Frank, is whether when you have a situation, which I think you agree, defense counsel misadvised Mr. Vogel about his ability to move forward with an appeal following his entry of a guilty plea. And given the fact that, I mean, it seems to me it's either accurate or not accurate. You either have that right or you don't. And when he's completely given the wrong information, how can we say in any practical sense that his decision was intelligent when he wasn't given the right information on which to make his decision?
Judge Bjorkman, from the state's perspective, it's a bit more nuanced than that. It's misadvice. It's not necessarily incorrect advice. The record is clear, and trial counsel's testimony repeatedly stated that that issue was addressed. It is clear that he did not say, that trial counsel did not say, I am guaranteeing your right to appeal. Go forward with the guilty plea. You can definitely appeal. That is not what the record reflects. The record reflects that the issue, that the consequence on the appellate issue was addressed. And counsel informed the client that he believed that there is a distinct possibility. In fact, informing the client that you may be jeopardizing your appellate review rights by going forward with the guilty plea. I certainly agree that it was misadvice. However, he did flag the issue. The defendant, the appellant, knew that by going forward with the guilty plea that he could be jeopardizing his appellate rights.
Counsel, is that enough, flagging the issue? I mean, that's the issue for us. Is it enough to simply say distinct possibility, could be, could not be? Is that enough? I mean, is that enough to require a counsel that he just kind of throw it up in the air like that and say it could happen, might not happen?
It's not enough, Judge Cleary, for purposes of the misadvice. It is enough to show that he was not prejudiced by the misadvice.
How so?
And we have two prongs. We have to show that the attorney's conduct fell below an objective standard. I think we all agree that happened. But in order to show the Strickland standard, you have to show that error resulted in prejudice. And the record here shows that the appellant was not prejudiced. He got the benefit of his bargain. He decided to shift strategies.
Well, he did. Certainly he changed tactics and entered a plea and had several counts dismissed. And there was some issues surrounding whether or not there was some witness tampering and all the rest of that. But can we honestly say that he intelligently waived his right when he did not know that he was fully waiving his appellate right?
Under these facts, the respondent would answer that with yes. Absolutely, that was an intelligent plea because that issue was flagged. And I would note that that issue was also addressed at least somewhat during the guilty plea colloquy when Judge Benshoof asked if the defendant had any questions. And the appellant's response was crystal clear. No, Mr. Schindlersheim explained everything very thoroughly. And he knew that going forward with the guilty plea could jeopardize his right to appellate review as it relates to the issue of speedy trial demand. From the respondent's perspective, that issue may very well still be ripe, but and I address it in my appeal from the standpoint that if the court looked at the record, it would find that the Barker Wingo factors established that there was good cause to continue the trial when the court evaluates State versus Terry, that 1980 Minnesota Supreme Court decision, as well as the Johnson case referred to in my brief. So the answer is yes, Judge Cleary.
So this is an aside, just a quick question because I found it concerning. Trial counsel testified that it wasn't the general practice to do felony plea petitions in Beltrami County.
Typically it's not. I would agree with that. We use plea petitions. The practice with our four judges up in Beltrami County is we go through rights on the record. Quite honestly, in the past, that has helped us in terms of appellate review.
I can imagine.
And as it relates to Garza in Florida, and I just want to address Judge Bjorkman's question to Mr. Withall as it relates to credibility determinations. I guess I would disagree with my colleague, Mr. Withall. I think that he is asking this court to overturn a credibility determination. If the court looks at that, it's pretty clear that his client's testimony as to whether he would have gone forward with the trial but for Mr. Schindlersheim's error is not credible. It's simply not credible on the record because of his varying testimony, indicating that all of his testimony was not credible. And as a result, we think this court is obligated to affirm the credibility determinations. It is clearly far from clearly erroneous. It is not clearly erroneous. And his shifting tactics made sense in terms of the benefit that he received as it relates to disposition after his guilty plea. I would note that, as I indicated earlier, that the intelligence prong under State versus Rally has been shown. He did understand the charges. He did understand the rights that he was waiving, and he understood the consequences of going forward with that guilty plea. Mr. Schindlersheim's testimony at the hearing was very clear. I informed him, and I am paraphrasing, but I informed my client that going forward with the guilty plea could jeopardize his appellate rights. The response from the appellant was, I don't care. I want to go forward with the guilty plea. That shows a knowing and intelligent decision irrespective of the consequences on appellate rights.
So can, is it, would it be appropriate for us to consider the fact that right after the hearing, he asked for an application for an appellate public defender? I mean, that that part of the testimony?
Possibly, Judge. I don't think that that testimony was fully developed, though. What did that mean? Was he concerned about a sentence as it relates to the conditions of his sentence? Did it relate to the issue of speedy trial? We don't have that information. So I don't think the court can place a lot of stock in his in that testimony. And briefly, with the short amount of time that I have left, the respondent would argue that we have met the Barker versus Wingo factors. The length of the delay was not all that long. The reason for the delay was appropriate. We were trying to find a necessary witness, and I would rely on State versus Terry and the Johnson decision reflected in my brief. Based upon my earlier arguments, the record shows that the delay did not prejudice the defendant.
All right, thank you, counsel. Mr. Withall, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. To answer Judge Siegel's question about these appellate forms, I would direct this court's attention in my limited time to page 25 of the post-conviction hearing transcripts. Page 25 discusses not only giving Mr. Vogel the forms immediately after pleading guilty, but also in that same context, the trial attorney is testifying to Mr. Vogel's ongoing complaining about this speedy trial, and the response being, and I'm quoting this on the record, "Hey, if you want, you can appeal this." So I think the record is pretty well developed on that issue. Regarding tactics is absolutely relevant on the question of a valid guilty plea. But remember, Your Honors, the manifest injustice standard has three prongs: the tactics, the forfeiture by wrongdoing, the risk of a greater sentence, all goes toward the voluntariness prong of the manifest injustice standard. This informs whether the defendant was free of undue pressures or was pleading guilty to avoid consequences, and whether that was a legitimate and voluntary plea. The intelligence prong doesn't examine the voluntariness of the plea. The intelligence prong ensures that the defendant understands the rights that he is waiving. Concerning tactics, I think it's actually a very common tactic. I can speak from almost 10 years as an appellate public defender reviewing guilty pleas. A common tactic is exactly as Mr. Frank pointed out, to plead guilty in the hope to challenge dispositive issues on appeal. Defendants will do this all the time, but the only proper way to do this that's authorized by the rules of criminal procedures under Rule 26, what is colloquially, and forgive me, this is a dirty word, a Lothenbach plea. There is a legitimate procedure to say, "Hey, I'll take this deal, but I still want to litigate this dispositive issue at the Court of Appeals, because then I'm not, can't be convicted of this crime." You see this in cases like Myrie and cases before it, where this is a totally legitimate practice to ease the burdens on the district court from having to go through the motions of a trial on the issue of guilt when the evidence is actually pretty strong, notwithstanding this dispositive issue, often a search issue, sometimes a speedy trial issue. Any of these issues that can be preserved that are dispositive on the issue of guilt. So I acknowledge that that those factors might be relevant to the voluntariness of the plea, and that the plea probably was entirely voluntary. It wasn't promised anything by the state that was unenforceable. It goes to the intelligence and the defendant's understanding of the right to appeal this dispositive and fully litigated constitutional right that we can't present to this court today because he pled guilty, and in part because the record shows that Mr. Vogel did not understand this, in part because of the district court's failure to make a record at the time of the plea, the absence of the plea petition, and defense counsel's affirmative misadvice.
Um,
The other thing that concerns me is the post-conviction court's findings on, and Mr. Frank brought this up as well, that Mr. Vogel didn't complain about this issue at the time of the plea. And I want to remind this court, as it maybe said six or seven times today, that it's the district court's responsibility to create a record of the defendant's understanding at the time of the plea, not the defendant's obligation to make sure that he asks questions to the court about rights that he's already consulted his attorney on, whether he got a correct answer, an equivocal answer or not. Because it is the court's responsibility, and you know, I think in part the court relies on this presumption of competence by defense counsel. That's kind of where the foundation fails, and in part probably why plea petitions are so important.
Mr. Withall, if we agree with you that the court was under an obligation to ensure that your client understood that he was waiving not only trial rights but appeal rights by entering a plea of guilty not in a Loefenbach situation, would this court be creating new common law? I mean, no, that says that?
There's no case addressing this specific issue in the context of the manifest injustice standard. I'm drawing on well-established principles in other cases and asking this court to extend them to this case. The context that this more comes up is where defense counsel is failing. And in every one of these appeals, the first question is, who messed up? Was it the prosecutor's misconduct, did the district court mess up, or was it the trial counsel being deficient? I see my time is up, and I ask the court to find that either trial counsel or the district court's obligations were not met, and to allow Mr. Vogel to withdraw his plea. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. Thank you both. Your arguments were helpful, and the briefing as well, and we appreciate that. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.